On a Thursday morning here around Mosaic on WCMU, I'm David Nicholas with you till noon, but on the indoors to talk about the concert that will be given in the indoors of the Midland Center for the Arts, the concert this Saturday evening at 7:30. The Midland Symphony Orchestra, led by music director and conductor Bohuslav Rutte, works of Gershwin and Prokofiev, and the Gershwin works featuring a Bay City native and renowned Gershwin performer and aficionado, Kevin Cole. We welcome both into a studio this morning. Good to have you here, gentlemen.
Thank you, David.
Good morning.
You don't choose then to rework and give the concert outdoors then? That's not something you're considering at all, to put it out on the lawn over?
All the instruments would survive. Yeah, especially the piano. That would be beautiful.
I think a setting in Dow Gardens would be very nice for this Saturday night.
I think only if they made one of those ice castles where they serve the vodka in the cubes, you know, then we might consider it.
So it is an option. We'll present it to the crew over there and see if they want to do that. All the information about the concert this Saturday is at midlandcenter.org. On the program, Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue and his New York Rhapsody and the Prokofiev Symphony number 5. You should know by now, Maestro, I always like to get a sense in terms of when you feature a soloist, the piece that joins that. And so how did we arrive at a Gershwin and Prokofiev combo for this this weekend's performance?
That's a good question. But, you know, the orchestration is very similar. In other words, it requires the same amount of players. So that's always something we look at, you know, as I mentioned before. It's always fun to deal with the people higher ups who say what the budget for a concert is. When you come and you tell them, I'm hiring a saxophone player for 6 notes, and he's going to get paid exactly the same money as the first violinist who's playing thousands of notes. So it's always fun. Now, Prokofiev, I love Prokofiev. I mean, it's probably one of my favorite composers. And of course, this symphony from the Soviet era and the Symphony of Free Men, as we call it, is a piece on its own. Beautiful work, somewhat different than what our audiences are used to. So it's going to be very interesting to see how they react to the piece. And then,
had you played that before in Midland then, or is this the first performance of this piece?
Well, yeah. We'd have to look back and see, but I don't think this piece has been done in a very, very long time. Hmm. You know? So it's an interesting combo. I think it works quite well, actually.
And the chance then to work with Kevin Cole, who is a native of Bay City, but this is his premiere with the MSO, and a chance to perform these works by Gershwin. How did the two of you start getting the idea that this might be a fun thing to do?
You might have to ask my staff.
Well,
here.
Matt Travis, who is at the center, he is a friend from Bay City, and probably a couple of years ago, once he came on board at the Midland Center for the Arts, he said, haven't you played with the symphony? And I said, no. And he said, well, let me see what I can do.
Let's change
that. So he started, you know, talking to people there, and then he approached Maestro, and then they just figured it out. And I had suggested to Matt, instead of doing like the concerto in F, which traditionally would be usually the first piece you'd play, and especially if it's going to be part of the season concert and not a Pops offering, I suggested doing the two Rhapsodies because the Rhapsody in Blue, of course, is the most played piano orchestra work on the planet in any given year. But the second Rhapsody...
Especially if you fly United.
That's it. But the second Rhapsody, or as Gershwin...
So for those who sort of had the tune halfway going through their head, now it's stuck there. Now
that's
it's
it.
Oh, my God. Oh, that's what they're talking about. Okay. I'm on board now.
But the second Rhapsody, it's interesting in that Gershwin had many titles for it. It started out as a work that was used for a dream sequence in the movie Delicious in 1931, about an 8-minute work. And Gershwin liked it so much, he said, I'm going to turn this into a full-fledged work. And he didn't say for piano with orchestra. It's very distinctly in his handwriting says on the opening page, for orchestra with piano. So the orchestra, it's almost like a concerto for orchestra, and the piano was almost their equal. But it's a Gershwin of the 30s, which is a totally different style of writing, very angular. But it's also a New York of the 30s because he wrote the piece. The dream sequence is this Scottish immigrant. She comes over and she's seeing Manhattan for the first time. And she's walking the streets and skyscrapers and people on the streets. And it scares her. And the music, he originally had called this piece Rhapsody in Rivets. Thank goodness that didn't survive. But then it became New York Rhapsody until a couple weeks before the premiere, which was with the Boston Symphony and Koussevitzky. And they said, well, you need a more dignified title than New York Rhapsody. So he said Second Rhapsody. But years ago, I asked the Gershwins if it would be okay if I would use New York Rhapsody because it's a little more romantic, a little more descriptive, but also would pique the interest of the audience who most have never heard this piece. In fact, I was just telling Maestro, I think this is only the sixth or seventh time I've ever performed it. I have performed it with an orchestra.
For the amount of Gershwin that you perform, not that many, let alone then. And why do you think that is? The overwhelming popularity of the Rhapsody in Blue? And people don't want to get out of that comfort zone or that familiarity?
Well,
or
it's two things, and one of them Maestro can talk about. It's one is that, right, it was overshadowed by the Rhapsody in Blue. It didn't have a tune, per se, like the main love theme, as we like to call it, in the Rhapsody. But also, from an orchestra standpoint,
it's hard.
It's hard, yeah.
It's actually pretty hard. We read it last night during our first rehearsal, which was actually a kind of a rehearsal, kind of not a rehearsal, because a lot of the players were missing, especially the ones who are coming from Lansing and West Michigan. They just decided not to drive because the conditions on the roads were so miserable. So they called in and said, look, we started driving, and after half an hour, we realized there's no point coming up here because we might not ever make it home after the rehearsal. So we were missing quite a few people, actually. So that's a strange way of rehearsing because you go through the piece, and you know some of the lines are missing because the players are not there for whatever reason. So it was weird to play it through. And of course, the rest of the orchestra is used to hearing certain things, and now you don't hear those lines. Like, for example, in the Prokofiev Symphony, the tuba is extremely important instrument. The way he writes for tuba, which is unusual because usually composers use tuba as kind of the bottom of the orchestra that plays the same line as the bass, right? They kind of, a lot of the time, is the same. No, not Prokofiev. He writes something totally different for tuba and for the basses. And it's so pronounced that when you are rehearsing the orchestra and it's not there, it just freaks everybody out, you know? So it was a kind of an experience last night to go through the Rhapsodies and the symphony without, you know, some of the major players, you know, not there. So that was interesting. But the Rhapsody, yeah, you're absolutely right. Oh, it's difficult to play. And because it's unknown to many of the players, they never played it before, so a lot of them struggle with it. To get through it because it's not under their, you know, usual repertoire.
But talk a little bit more too about what Kevin was referring to, and that it was written in a much different style than the Rhapsody in Blue. I mean, you say, you know, quite clearly that it's a difficult piece to play, but does that go to this idea of it's more the concerto for orchestra, that the piano is there and the absence then of that theme to glue it all together? What are some of those things that make this such an unusual, beyond the lack of familiarity that players might have with it or an audience might have with it, that makes it so much more different than perhaps some of the other types of pieces that orchestras or soloists would have experience in playing?
Well, I'll give it to you because you probably have a better answer. I just want to say that until Matt told me we are, you know, thinking about Second Rhapsody, I was like, what? What Rhapsody? Never heard of it before.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, even I had to go and study my butt off to learn it and to get more familiar with it and all that, you know, because I never heard of it.
Well, it's a Gershwin, as I said, as Rhapsody in Blue is to the 1920s, Second Rhapsody or New York Rhapsody is Gershwin of the 30s. And he was kind of stretching his orchestration bones. And in many ways, had he not done the Second Rhapsody, I don't think the orchestrations for Porgy and Bess, which is really his masterpiece, would have been as strong and as beautiful. He started studying with a guy named Joseph Schillinger. And Schillinger was a very interesting character. so many people went to him, Oscar Levant, Glenn Miller, Benny Goodman, people like this were going to study with him. And what he was doing was giving them a system using mathematics and color to help somebody not write themselves into a corner with a theme. Gershwin was having difficulty when he was working on the Second Rhapsody, and somebody said, you should go see Schillinger, and he did. And you either clicked with his ideas of mathematics and color, or you didn't. Some people said, oh, he doesn't know, it's all bunk. But he helped a lot of people. And when you think about Glenn Miller, who did wonderful orchestrations, and Benny Goodman, these people, they must have felt that what he was giving them opened something up in them. From what I've read, he took away, Schillinger would take away any conventions as far as you could apply what he was telling you to any type, any style of music, any type of music. Gershwin just knew he had to get himself out of a corner thematically with what he was writing. So you have that. So, and also New York had changed from the 20s. Architecture, music, art, everything had changed. So we're getting a glimpse into the Gershwin of the 30s, which in turn would have given us a glimpse into Gershwin of the 40s had he lived longer. So it's just, it's a little harder edge. There's more clashing of themes and keys. I mean, he's writing sometimes, you know, keys half step apart that you're playing one chord in C, one in D flat at the same time. And this was not the very melodic, you know, concerto in F. This was more conflict in the music.
How do you think, Maestro, that style and so forth, what other works might we point to that followed, not necessarily, obviously not from Gershwin because of the end of his life, but other works that sort of then took that idea forward? Is there any others that come to mind that...
Of other composers?
Other composers, yeah.
Prokofiev could be a good example, actually. Yeah,
yeah. In the 30s, people were starting to... Well, the 20s were very melodic music-wise, especially anything in the jazz line. And since there more jazz was being woven into, or at least the freedom of jazz was starting to enter into composers' minds as they wrote, and Gershwin was certainly one of the ones that utilized that, as did Copland, as did Ravel. Prokofiev, maybe to some extent.
Yeah.
I don't know. But you're hearing these new sounds coming out of an orchestra, new combinations of notes and chords. And also, if you were living in New York, as many of these composers were, or at least exposed to New York, there was a certain vitality and an energy of a city now that was had an identity. When Gershwin came along, American music really didn't have an identity other than Stephen Foster, you know, pretty much. Maybe some Irving Berlin and Kern, but that was show music to people. So Gershwin was the catalyst, really, to take all these different cultures in New York and try to put it into music and give us, as Americans, an identity in music. He wasn't the only one, but he was the one that became the superstar, you know, on the first American composer on the cover of Time magazine, things like that. So I think any writing that happened after the 20s, which was kind of the free-for-all jazz age, you know, ballet mécanique and all these things where you're putting a typewriter and the sounds of airplane engines into your works, after all that experiment, then they said, okay, how do we make this a little more conventional? You know, so the audiences will take a bigger bite, and it's just not all wacky. And so I think, again, the music of the 30s in the concert hall, especially American music, was reflecting how we were getting our act together as Americans, I think.
Gershwin's New York Rhapsody, the second Rhapsody, but no, true to Gershwin's wishes, the New York Rhapsody will be one of the works performed along with the Rhapsody in Blue. We'll come to some Gershwin a little bit later on into the close of this hour. But as we had been mentioning too, the Prokofiev Symphony No. 5, his Opus 100, the Symphony in B-flat. And Maestro, you said that this piece, not only because of the instrumentation, but even some of the discussion we've had, brings to mind that there was at least, they weren't kindred souls, but at least in terms of some of the stylistic things pointing in those directions, Prokofiev and Gershwin might have, in some ways, merged along quite well into the future. Talk a little bit more about this than this Symphony No. 5. You mentioned its ties to the influence of Soviet Russia at the time. We'll be turning to the finale of the work here in just a moment, but to give people a little bit more of an idea of the flavor of the piece as a whole.
Well, yes, you know, Prokofiev during Soviet Russia was probably the most performed composer, right? I mean, Shostakovich was on the blacklist, and finally after the fall of Stalin and and the Soviet kind of empire, then he was played more. But at that time, it was 1944 where he wrote it. And during the premiere, it was actually announced right before the premiere that the war was coming to somewhat close because there were some big victories of the Soviet army at that time. So I think he, you know, he had the life of, at that moment, at that time for Prokofiev. He was remarried to his second wife of about 4 years. He had a really good career composing, and his music was played. So he was a happy man at that time. And as I said, you know, the war was supposedly coming to close, some of these big victories of the army. So, yes, it's very Soviet when you think about it. You know, you also have to, I grew up in, you know, Czechoslovakia in the, I was born, what year? 72. So it was, you know, I lived through the communism the first 14 years of my life or so after it went down. So every time I hear Soviet, you know, my hair just starts standing up on my head, you know, because we were pushed to learn Russian. We were basically brainwashed into thinking that the Soviet empire is the empire. You probably saw a bunch of movies about it, documentaries, how it all went. There's an actually interesting show on TV called The Americans. I don't know if you mm-hmm. ever heard of it. Yep. It's about spies living in the United States. And so it the way they thought about the Mother Russia, you know, we were... So that type of music, to me, always resonates. I always see tanks. I always see machine guns kind of thing. Every time you mention Russia and Soviet Union, you know, it gives me the chills because I lived through some of it. Obviously, I was a child, so it's for a kid growing up, it's totally different than what my parents had to go through, you know, as an adult living through those times. But in that symphony, I hear a lot of that that pride that the Soviets had. And on one hand, it's extremely sad for me to kind of reflect on that because I know the times were really bad at, you know, what the Soviets put half of the world through. And on the other hand, it's a fantastic music to be able to, you know, conduct and work with musicians and make it happen. So I'm kind of split personality on this thing. But yeah, you hear the last movement and towards the end, I mean, it's like just tanks rolling through the Russian fields, you know, and the machine guns going on. It's pretty amazing. If it's not really a programmatic music, he himself did not put any program to that to that symphony, but you can kind of hear it in the background, that the Soviet pride of Mother Russia.
The Symphony No. 5, Opus 100, the Symphony in B-flat by Prokofiev. It's on the concert this Saturday evening. Begins at 7:30 with the Midland Symphony Orchestra at the Center for the Arts, and guest soloists performing works of Gershwin. Also on the program, Kevin Cole, he at Maestro Bohuslav Rutte, joining us in studio today. All the information, again, at MidlandCenter.org. We'll talk a little bit more about Gershwin's famed Rhapsody in Blue in a short while. They are with us in this hour. I'm David Nicholas with you till the noon hour today, and through that midday, sitting in for Amy Robinson on Here and Now. We'll turn to Footlight Parade coming up in the 3 o'clock hour today. Judy Wagley, your host for Afternoon Classical Music. Judy and I will both be along to say hello and spend some time with you pre the concert and the intermission and the like at the Midland Center for the Arts this Saturday evening. 7:30, the curtain rises on the concert with the Midland Symphony Orchestra led by Bohuslav Rutte, and they will be playing that Prokofiev Symphony No. 5 in its entirety. And also on the program, the New York Rhapsody, the Second Rhapsody, the Rhapsody in Rivets, the All that we have talked about quite extensively, that second work of Rhapsody fame by Gershwin, and also the beloved Rhapsody in Blue. Kevin Cole is with us, as is Maestro Rutte here this morning on Mosaic. Thank you for coming out again in the cold. We appreciate that. We've already deemed that we will not be giving an outdoor concert on Sunday.
Yeah, because then the blue in Rhapsody would really be true.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, yeah. Another place, another time when it would be more suited. But this piece, and we'll be hearing some of it as our hour concludes here today. But it you said it represented Gershwin of the 20s, and it. Different from, a full concerto, the style, but obviously it is so identified with him and has been played so many times. In fact, I think you said that you have probably played it. You think,
in the four digits, yeah, over 1,000 easily, yeah.
In a very long career, yes, but it's still most often requested, most often sought after.
Yeah, it really is. When they take a survey of works for piano and orchestra and how they're programmed with orchestras around the world, it is still number one. And it's closely followed by maybe a three-way tie. The concerto in F would be the next one, tied with Tchaikovsky number one and Rachmaninoff second. So Gershwin's in
pretty
good company.
Yeah, I would say so. That's some rarefied air.
Well,
so.
When you think about it, somebody once said to me, and it really clicked, was that Gershwin wrote, I believe, 7 works for orchestra, 4 of those with piano. And then Mahler only wrote, 9, 10 symphonies, if you count 10 or whatever. And yet these works are performed countless times in any given season. Whereas if you asked Mozart Symphony number 38, hum it, it's not so much the volume of which these people wrote, but what they wrote had such an impact on the listener as well as musicians. So it's very interesting because the legacy is very small from Gershwin, but yet there's just something about it, the freshness and in fact, the Rhapsody just was this burst of energy. It almost wasn't written, and it was his brother Ira that saw in the newspaper 6 weeks before this concert that George Gershwin was busily writing a piano... jazz piano concerto, and he said, "No, I'm not." And so that he wrote this in such a short time, to the point where the Paul Whiteman Band that premiered it on the day of the concert, which was Lincoln's birthday, February 12th, 1924, Gershwin didn't have time to even write out all his piano parts because, as you know, there are sections in the Rhapsody where it's just the piano, but he was very kind in that he wrote a little note to Whiteman on the page where it was blank where the piano's playing solo, and it consisted of 3 words: wait for nod. So, can you imagine the conductor, is that a nod? And then bring the band back in. So it's a work that is just a flash of lightning at that moment that captured.
Are you gonna be nodding tomorrow?
Well, I hope not. No, I don't.
Are you working from a complete score this time?
Yeah. I think it's great that my introduction to Maestro here are these 2 works because they are so different, but yet they're so Gershwin. And it's so rare you get to hear both sides, the 20s and 30s Gershwin. And I have a feeling that, I'll be looking for his nod to bring me in, not the other way around.
Just as long as you figure out who's nodding to who, because then it suddenly will be like the John Cage piece, the 4.5 minutes or whatever, and then 4:33, and nothing will be happening, and then the people in the audience will be saying, do we clap here? Do we not?
Well, we can guarantee that no one will be nodding off. That's
okay,
the thing we can guarantee.
Exactly. How did he? Because he was working so much in collaboration with his brother too, whose life then obviously extended long beyond his. But that there's that partnership, and then there are these works that are solely George's. You say a work that came about quickly, but what were they in the midst of doing that he was able to set it aside or channel the energies into this piece at the same time?
He didn't set aside. He's getting ready for tryouts in Boston of a musical called Sweet Little Devil. And so he was, like, the very next day after Ira saw this in the paper, which they believe was, like, January 4th, George was shooting pool with a buddy when Ira read this, you know, this concert that Paul Whiteman was giving, Experiment in Modern Music, and he's going to answer the question, what is American music? Well, in 1924, what is American music? It wasn't very much at that point, okay? But Gershwin had to call Whiteman and say, there's no way I can do this. He said, how did this come about? He said, don't you remember? They were at some cocktail party in 1923 and had this conversation. George, would you write something? Oh, sure, Paul. George completely forgot about it. But Whiteman said, and he expected a concerto, a three-movement concerto, and Gershwin said, I can't do that. We've got five, six weeks away. He said, but I will do a rhapsody, something more free-form. And so Ferdy Groffay of Grand Canyon Suite fame was the chief arranger for the Whiteman Band. So basically, Gershwin, after he came back from his train trip to Boston, he said he had his little jot book with him, and on that train ride, the complete rhapsody, like Mozart, he heard the complete rights from beginning to end. It was just a matter of writing it down after that on a train ride, because that clickety-clack, the rhythms and all that, it forced him. This is what Gershwin needed. He needed a deadline like this to really force all these ideas, finally do a serious work. So when he got back, Groffay's at the table. Gershwin's at an upright, and as fast as he's writing things, Groffay is scoring it for Whiteman's special needs, because he had band members that could play 5-6 instruments, you know? So it's just that whole flurry. They only had 2 rehearsals before the concert, and in the audience was Rachmaninoff and Heifetz and Alma Gluck and Efren Zimlis Jr. I mean, all these, Efren Zimlis, not Jr., all these heady musicians, and they were supposed to, at the end of the concert, give their whatever, say on what is American music. Well, it was just a publicity stunt, basically. But the audience, the rhapsody was put on the almost at the end of the program that included Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance. What that has to do with American music, I don't know. But the audience was starting to leave Aeolian Hall because this was it's almost, what, we're going into the third hour. And they heard that opening clarinet whoop, and people said, what is this? And sat down, and with Gershwin, a dashing 25-year-old pianist, taking the lead, if I had a time machine, if I could go back to any moment, I'd want to be
that.
Because he opened up the doors to American music in the concert hall. My friend Ed Jablonski, who was the noted Gershwin biographer and American music writer from Bay City, lo and behold, he said to me that before Gershwin came along, in order for an American work to be played in an American concert hall, you had to be either European-born or dead, preferably both. So Gershwin really opened up the floodgates with one piece, Rhapsody in Blue.
I wanted to ask you, Maestro, about, because I'm sure it's a work that you have had the opportunity to put on concerts many other times, but the approach this time, and we say this with all respect and reverence for the position that Kevin has with the legacy of the Gershwin family, the connection, the sanctioning and blessing of the family to carry on the music as the renowned reformer, how has this approach to coming to this work been in a different setting? And this is not to slight any other pianist that you've worked with, but to approach these works, and in particular this that we'll hear, with a soloist like Kevin Cole. What has that experience been like?
There's no real difference. You prepare the best you can for anybody you work with. I don't think I would, you know, treat less or more anybody else. You do it professional way. You learn the scores. You do as best as your capability, you know, allows you. So from that, no, it was just... The New York Rhapsody, as we call it, here, that took a little more time because it's such an unknown piece. I mean, for me, it was an unknown piece, you know, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners will be also on the same boat, like, he wrote what? Here we go. Now your chance to hear it on Saturday to the piece that, you know, is not being performed. So it took a little more time to figure all that out. And, of course, then we got into trouble with different editions also. That's another thing, you know, that Kevin plays the original, and I think we got a different edition that we wanted, so we had to switch back and forth, you know, so that took a little bit of adjusting as well. So, yeah, it took a bit of time to learn it.
I think the tradition has it that the conductor and the soloist, we meet ahead of time, I play and we adjust tempos, and he goes, oh, you take it like that, okay. And so we get all of our ducks in a row. So with the orchestra, and especially with the Rhapsody, because the orchestras have played it so many times that sometimes they just sit way back in their chair and go, oh, here we go, another Rhapsody. But the big difference will be tempos. I mean, they will be brisk. They will be more in line with the tempos Gershwin did. But as much as I've been accused of being Gershwin reincarnated, it's not that at all in my view. I can't play like Gershwin, even though I may sound like the recordings, because I didn't study to do that. What I can do in my job as a soloist is to capture the energy of whatever piece I'm performing, be it Gershwin or someone else. And I think just for some reason, his music speaks to me in a way that I can try to recreate that kind of electricity to an audience that has heard this piece many times. People always come up to me, how did you make this sound so fresh and so different when I have every recording of this piece and I know this work, and yet it sounded like I'm hearing it for the first time? I said, well, then I did my job. That's my job.
Very true.
Yeah.
Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, Gershwin's New York Rhapsody, Sergei Prokofiev's Symphony No. 5, all in concert, beginning at 7:30, Midland Center for the Arts, the Midland Symphony, joined by Kevin Cole. A performance with Kevin as soloist as we head out of this hour on this Thursday morning. Thank you, gentlemen, both. We look forward to the concert and in and around weather and challenges and tempos and nods. enjoy the rest of the preparation. We look forward to concert time come Saturday evening. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thanks, David.